Flags and the National Hockey League. We're going to talk about Mr. Big operations. Now, these are the police tactics that get a suspect to try to admit to a crime. Well, they try to get a suspect to admit to a crime. It's very tactful, and it's very legally dangerous. They sometimes do not go as planned. And our next guest is Michael Mulligan. He's a lawyer with Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson here in Victoria. And as he does on Thursdays, he's joining us here on CFAX 1070. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
These Mr. Big operations, they go back. The RCMP is big into this, is it not? Pardon the expression, big, but...
Yeah, that's true. Supreme Court of Canada reviewed that last year in a case dealing with these, and they've been used several hundred times over the last couple of decades in Canada. The general premise of these things is that when the police have run cold on an investigation, but they still have a suspect in mind, the Mr. Big operation involves a whole team of undercover RCMP officers. And what they'll do is that they will inject themselves into the life of the suspect through whatever mechanism is available to them, befriend the suspect, and then they will let on that they're a member of a criminal organization, and they will build the trust of the suspect by having them participate in a series of tasks or scenarios. They'll have them do things like deliver packages or keep a lookout, to this sort of thing.
Phony plots,
that's right. And they'll usually pay the suspect, in some cases substantial amounts of money, thousands of dollars, in these sort of payments for being engaged with this fictitious organization. And then at the end of the operation, usually after a number of months, and this is where the name Mr. Big comes from, they will have one RCMP officer playing the role of the fictitious crime boss of this fictitious criminal organization. The message that the crime boss will give the accused or the suspect is they'll say, look, if you want to be a member of our organization, if you want to keep getting paid thousands of dollars, they'll also do things like take them for dinner, take them on trips across the country, put them up in fancy hotels, this sort of thing. They'll say, look, what you need to do is to confess to us that you've committed some crime. And in one of the scenarios, they'll say, you know, we're aware of this thing that you're being investigated for. We've discovered that you're going to be charged and will certainly be convicted if you don't confess to it. But if you'll confess to it, we can then fix it. We'll have somebody who will take the fall for you, or will pay off the police officer or whatever it might be, and present the person with the option of either denying the thing that they're being investigated for, in which case they would be ejected from the lucrative criminal organization,
right?
Likely convicted of crime, or they'll be told, if you just confess to doing it, we'll fix it all, and you can be a member of our organization and continue to receive thousands of dollars. You'll live a life of luxury. That technique is often successful in extracting confessions from people. They're just such powerful inducements. The problem that arises is that the confessions aren't always truthful. Some people will simply lie to the fictitious crime boss, purporting to have committed some crime, not because they've done it, but because they wish to continue to receive money, or because they're fearful that they'll be wrongfully convicted of something they didn't do.
Right.
And it can have, that's of course a serious problem. So the Supreme Court of Canada last year set out some rules to try and deal with that and manage the risk and prejudice of this sort of tactic the police use. And the approach that the Supreme Court of Canada has now required is one that presumes those sort of confessions to be inadmissible unless the Crown can show that they should be admissible. And that process involves the trial judge balancing the probative value of the confession, sort of how useful is that evidence, against the prejudicial effect of letting that evidence into the trial.
Right.
And that would involve things like, was the confession, in terms of whether it's probative, did the person, for example, admit to something that no one other than the actual killer could have known, for example? That might make it very probative.
Right.
Or was it some just generic statement to the Mr. Big figure saying, yes, I did it, but with nothing that would allow you to sort out whether that's truthful or not.
So for a Mr. Big operation to be on the right path, as far as the police is concerned, are concerned, if they can get a suspect to say something that only the killer or the perpetrator, let's say, would know, that would be a big bonus for their case.
That's correct. That would go a long way to dealing with the issue of how probative is that evidence. Is it reliable? You know, when you have if you have the person say, look, I committed the act and then I, buried a ring with the body. And sure enough, there's a ring with the body. And nobody else would have known that.
Who would have known, right?
That would make it very probative. The prejudicial effect, or one of the potential prejudicial effects, is when the police lure somebody into this sort of a scenario, the evidence then comes out as this person having agreed to participate in this series of fake criminal activity, delivering packages and keeping watch and all this sort of thing. And it would then potentially leave the jury with the impression that, hey, this is a general person involved in general criminal conduct. And if you weigh that against a confession which is induced by offers of money and threats of being convicted wrongly, and where there's nothing to determine whether this is just some general admission to help the person or whether there's something specific, a judge may choose to exclude the evidence. A judge also now has to go on and consider whether a second part of the test would be sort of whether the conduct of the police involves sort of excessively abusive conduct. So if the police...
What kind of action would that be?
Well, the Supreme Court gave examples of things like the use of violence or threats of violence. Okay. So let's say the Mr. Big figure, the RCMP officer, told the suspect, confess to the murder or your family will be killed.
Right.
And then you got the person to say, yes, I did it, and I buried the ring with the body. That might be very probative. It's important evidence. They mentioned the ring. Who else would know that? But on the other hand, we don't want the police engaging in conduct like threatening people's lives in order to get them to say something, or using actual physical violence. If you were torturing somebody and managed to get them to confess, that would be unacceptable.
The word duress comes to mind.
Yes, that would be a fair description of it. We had a local case, which was an example of this just a couple of weeks ago. So this does happen, and it happens with some surprising frequency, the use of this technique.
Mm-hmm.
That was a local case where there was an issue about whether a man had killed a child, or whether the child died by falling off of a wet bathtub, hitting their head.
Yes.
And in that case, there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute the person initially, so the police applied this very technique. They injected themselves into this person's life. They started to pay them to perform these tasks. They persuaded the person to, in fact, quit their job, and then promised them riches if they could be a member of this fictitious criminal organization. And then finally got the person to, after a couple of denials, finally get them to say, yes, I did it, to the Mr. Big character in that case. It was a local case. One of the lawyers on that case was Eliza Bates Smith. They argued, first of all, that the statement ought not to have been admitted at all on that test that I just talked about from the Supreme Court of Canada. And on that front, the judge allowed the confession into evidence, in part because the trial judge was sitting alone. There wasn't a jury.
Okay.
So the judge, recognizing the potential infirmities of that kind of evidence and the risk of people confessing to things they didn't do, allowed the evidence in part by saying, look, I'm a judge and I'm not going to be prejudiced by hearing about this fake criminal organization. But ultimately, the judge in that case had a reasonable doubt. The accused testified that they were innocent, and the judge found that the confession that they finally got after months by using this Mr. Big process simply wasn't reliable. You had the accused in that case, after several denials, eventually making some general statement that didn't have any of those things like hold back information or specific information that only the person would have if they were guilty.
Right.
So that was an example of the sort of dangers that can arise, and ultimately the outcome in that local case was to find the man not guilty.
Are police, because sometimes these things go awry and they're not getting the guilty verdict that they're looking for, are police becoming a little bit more reticent in using Mr. Big operations? Or is it still very, very, very popular? Popular is not a good word, but very effective in their minds.
Well, they're still going on, or derivations of them. I mean, the other example of a similar, not the same, but sort of a related technique was in the legislature bombing case.
Yeah.
That one, they used a not dissimilar technique to inject these undercover RCMP officers, a couple of hundred of them, ultimately worked on that case. That one had other troubling elements in it because they weren't investigating a crime which had certainly occurred in the past and trying to determine whether the suspect did it or not. That one has the elements of the accused not having done anything yet, and using one of these sort of undercover scenario with in that case fictitious jihadists encouraging activity.
Right.
And that one is currently being argued and being discussed in the context of whether the police conduct was entrapment.
Right. I wanted to ask you about entrapment. Let's hold it right there, because I want to get into this entrapment idea and where it sticks and where there might be a bit of a correlation, or at least a relation in some way, with the big Mr. Big operations that police forces across the country have been using here in Canada. We're going to take a break right now and come back and talk more with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam & Pearson. We're talking today about Mr. Big operations, and we're about to talk about entrapment on CFAX 1070.
Join the CFAX conversation on Facebook. Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070. Traffic got you down. We'll get you up and going with more traffic more often. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
In a Motor Trend article comparing Ram 1500 to the new F-150 and Silverado, Ram's combination of towing, hauling, luxurious interior, and unimpeachable fuel economy put it on top. 8 judges, 1 winner, no argument. Ram, the most fuel-efficient pickup ever.
Get a 2015 Ram 1500 ST regular cab for $21,498.
Guts, glory, Ram.
I'm Al Farabee with the latest from CFAX Santas Anonymous. Everyone in your family is invited to join the Santas Anonymous fun volunteer program called Kids Helping Kids. You can learn more about it at CFAXSantas.com or call 250-920-4644.
Helping Victoria children and families in need, no matter what the need. Donate to CFAX Santas Anonymous now at CFAX1070.com.
How Bell makes getting a smartphone better.
Alex wanted a better mobile carrier, and she switched to Bell. She loved everything they had to offer. An amazing selection of smartphones starting at $0, totally affordable rate plans, and access to BC's largest LTE network. And since 99% of customers choose to stay with Bell on a monthly basis, shouldn't you switch too?
Hurry into a Bell store today. Bell, switching just got better. Stop punishing yourself for buying the wrong mattress. It's never too late for a faucet.
Hi, I'm Dwayne from Faucet Mattress. Do yourself a favor and come and see how affordable an all-natural, locally made mattress can be. Our open concept allows you to see them being made while you test different styles and firmnesses. We even make all-natural crib mattresses.
Sleep naturally with Faucet Mattress. Proudly handmade in Victoria at 408 John Street. Online at fawcettmattress.com.
For less than the cost of an apple a day, Thompson Roof Treatment can keep the roof of an average house free of moss for its remaining life. Make a healthy choice for your roof with Thompson's exclusive Lifetime Moss Control Program. A proactive approach with early treatment will maximize the life of your roof, resulting in lower maintenance costs. Call Thompson Roof Treatment and ask about their Lifetime Moss Control Program. Protect your roof and its warranty with Thompson Roof Treatment. 385-3124. 385-3124.
Mom, what's that device between your toes?
It's a digital orthosis. I only wish I'd known about this treatment sooner.
Dr. Glenn Cornwell is dedicated to the prevention and correction of foot pain using direct milled prescription orthotics and digital orthosis. Digital orthosis fit between the toes and are designed to prevent progression of the bunion and hammer toe deformities. Through innovation and care, Dr. Glenn Cornwell Podiatry puts your best foot forward. Call 386-9353.
Improve your health, your fitness, and your life. Weekend Wellness with Brittany King, Saturdays at noon on CFAX 1070. The biggest news events, the stories in our community, understood. It's Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Good morning, Mark Brenning sitting in for the vacationing Pamela McCall, and it is Thursday, so it's time for Legally Speaking, and we're speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson, and we're right in the middle of discussing Mr. Big tactics. And my question to Michael was, is there a correlation or a relationship in some way between the Mr. Big tactics and entrapment? And Michael, you're about to talk about the legislature bombing situation.
Yes, there are certainly parallels there, at least in that legislative bombing case. Entrapment in Canada can take two forms. One is if the police are approaching somebody randomly to see if they can get them to commit a crime. But the other branch of entrapment is if the police go beyond providing just an opportunity to commit a crime, but instead induce the person to commit a crime. So in that legislative case, which is a relatively unique scenario, the police had spent months posing as fictitious jihadists. And eventually it would seem, or is alleged, they encouraged the accused to finally focus on the thing that they did. When they began investigating the accused in that legislative case, they apparently had ideas which were unsavory, but they were things like making rockets out of cow dung to fire at the legislature, or taking over a U.S. nuclear submarine. And they were a couple of they were heroin addicts or on methadone, living on social assistance in a basement suite in Vancouver. So people with literally no capacity to carry out the sort of things which the police described as harebrained and hokey.
Right.
And they used, after a number of months with them, finally got them to focus on the thing that they did. So there are certainly concerns which would be related ones there. In that one, it's being analyzed now by the trial judge in the context of whether what happened was entrapment. There's no doubt the accused finally did the thing. The question there for the trial judge would be, did the police go too far in inducing those accused into committing the act finally?
Yeah. Does this happen often where this, I'm going to say alleged entrapment or potential for entrapment, or whatever may have happened there, does that happen often? That's a long way to go to try to get somebody to do something wrong so you can convict them and put them in jail.
That's true. In that way, that case apparently involved a couple of hundred police officers and months of work with these two before they got them to go ahead and do the thing which they were charged with
and a lot of money
charged
too.
Doing, and no doubt cost a fortune.
Yeah,
the resources aren't usually expended in that way. Entrapment would more commonly come up on a day-to-day basis for things like drug cases. If the police are trying to get somebody to sell them drugs, issues will arise about things like, you know, was there any pre-existing reason to be suspicious this person was trying to sell drugs? Or did you just approach somebody at random, or call somebody up without any pre-existing reason to be suspicious they were involved in the drug trade?
Yeah.
So entrapment does arise, but it's unusual. You'd have hundreds of police officers spending months undercover before you manage to get the suspect to do something.
And where are we now in this situation with the case involving the two that were convicted of attempting to bomb the legislature?
That one is now the trial judge's going to be now dealing with the issue of entrapment. The way it works with entrapment is only after you're find that the person did the thing. There's no doubt they went and planted these non-functioning things that they thought were bombs at the legislature. It was caught on camera from multiple different angles by the RCMP. Only after that is settled does the trial judge then go on to analyze whether what the police did was entrapment or not. In the Mr. Big scenario, it's dealing typically with cases where there is the event occurred at some point in the past, and there's no doubt the event occurred, right? Like in the local case that was just dealt with, it was a child who died of a head injury, and the issue was whether the child had fallen off of a slippery bathtub or whether they had had their head hit into the ground.
Right.
So there's no doubt that that occurred. There was a child who passed away in the bathroom. The issue became whether, what was this? Was it an accident or was it a crime?
Right.
So at least in that respect, you don't have some of the concerns that arise in the, like the legislative bombing entrapment case, where the concern is, you know, would these people have even done anything had the police not spent months in this undercover capacity?
Yeah.
The other thing to note is the sort of the category of person that's often targeted by these.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, who do the police look at and say this would be a good opportunity to use a Mr. Big operation because we think this person has these qualities?
Usually it's people who would be already marginalized in society. They'd be people like the one in the Supreme Court of Canada last year. The individual was socially isolated, hardly left their apartment, was unemployed and impoverished. And it would be that category of or sort of person who may well be susceptible to, you know, the new friends who are paying them thousands of dollars, offering them employment opportunities, and wanting attention. Those are the sort of that's the sort of person who might be susceptible to this sort of operation.
Right.
But most people just aren't in their ordinary life sort of expecting people who they've known for months to turn out to be RCMP officers trying to trick them into confessing to something.
Yeah, so they kind of go for the gullible. We have Jeff on the line. Jeff is called CFAX 1070, and he is got he has a question for our guest, Michael Mulligan. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just wondering if in today's society, with the way police departments operate and all that, if they're making more mistakes than they used to, and if more like criminals are getting off or getting charged with something less because police are making more mistakes or there's more entrapment than there was, say, a generation ago.
Good question. Have things changed? Is this Mr. Big operations, sting operations, are they, and entrapment situations, are they more prevalent these days?
It is a technique which has become common. The Supreme Court of Canada mentioned 350 scenarios, Mr. Big scenarios, as of 2008 had been carried out. I should say, however, that I think, contrary to the suggestion that things are somehow getting worse, I think generally speaking, the justice system functions well. Generally, police investigations are carried out in a professional fashion.
Mm-hmm.
The police aren't generally interested in trying to convict innocent people of doing things. I would suspect in many of these Mr. Big cases that the police genuinely believe that the person committed the act. The worry is that well, their motives may be good ones, and they may be investigating a serious crime. Experience teaches us that this technique, from time to time, will produce confessions from innocent people.
Right.
Even if the police may be well motivated, we need to guard against the innocent being convicted.
Thanks for your time, Michael. Another interesting segment of